You always were the best, Lloyd. Best damn podcast from Timbuktu to Portland, Oregon. Or Portland, Maine, for that matter.
That was Dr. David Robertson. Needing to contextualize again. Did you do that for us, Doctor?
It's The Shining.
The Shining?
By Stanley Kubrick.
There we go. I was just listening to another podcast, not that I listen to any other podcast. Just talking about The Shining as I was walking down.
There are other podcasts.
Tush, what is this? What is this? So yes, I'm Christopher Carter, and he is indeed Dr. David Robertson.
Indeed.
I'm going to enjoy saying that for a while.
I know, me too. It's not worn off yet.
So congratulations, David. We are the Religious Studies Project. We are in the White Horse, which we recorded in before.
Yes, a return visit for us. Last time we were here, there was a ukulele group waiting to start. Which made our job a bit more complicated.
But we've got a good rapport with most of the pubs that we tend to go to. Today, it's back to Tommy Coleman, and he's talking with Tatiana Schnell about sources of meaning. Take it away, Tommy.
Welcome to the Religious Studies Project. This is Thomas Coleman. I'm here with Dr. Tatiana Schnell of the University of Innsbruck in Austria. She's going to talk to us a little bit today about meaning-making, her work on sources of meaning and what it might mean and its applications to the psychology of religion. So thank you for joining us, Dr.
Thank
Schnell.
Thank you for the invitation.
In the 2005 handbook of the psychology of religion and spirituality, they really put forth values and meanings as a construct for the psychology of religion to focus on. And the second edition, which was just published 2 or 3 months ago, really expounded upon meaning and an emphasis on it. So particularly interesting here is your sources of meaning scale, which you've developed. I was wondering if you could provide a brief explanation of the sources of meaning scale and potential applications for us. Mm-hmm.
Maybe some words about how the idea of developing the scale came up. In Europe, in Germany, where I'm coming from, for example, we have less and less people attaining church activities, and the churches lose influence on everyday life. But I have the feeling that not so many people were suffering from a crisis of meaning, and I was wondering, what is it that actually gives a basis to their lives? What is their foundation? And in a large qualitative study, we asked people about their personal myths. This is existentially relevant convictions about personal rituals and experiences of transcending to cover all areas of action, of cognition, of experience in that we deal with in psychology. Mm-hmm. And after each answer an interviewee gave, we started lettering, which is a technique developed by Dmitry Leontiev in Russia, which just means asking, what do you mean by that? What does it mean for you? What does that stand for? And we just kept asking and asking that question until the person arrived at a really ultimate meaning, a reason for why they do that, why they think that.
So as a researcher, you didn't just assume that some people consider this a source of values and meanings. You actually went out and wanted to learn from the population you're studying. What are your values and meanings?
Exactly, yes. I used a grounded theory approach, saying I don't want to expect anything, but we have to ask people from all walks of life, and we actually had them from all kinds of education levels and different religions and different social backgrounds, and they all could actually deal with these questions very well. If they are simply put, everybody is able to reflect on existential questions. And then we had these loads of ultimate values. They were thousands because the interviews went on up to 8 hours, and we had 64 people who were interviewed from 16 to 84 years. And these sources of meaning, these ultimate sources of meaning, were summarized and consensually validated in several steps, cyclical steps, by a team of researchers until we finally arrived at 26 sources of meaning that seemed to cover what people had said and that were not overlapping with each other. And we then transformed these sources of meaning into psychometric scales. After four versions of testing psychometrics and so on, the final showed me the sources of meaning, and meaningfulness or meaning in life was finished.
Cool. What are some of the strengths to focusing on values and meaning, specifically meaning and meaning-making in the psychology of religion?
First of all, it's important not to use values and meaning synonymously, because values are rather normative. How should the world be? What is right? And people tell us a lot when we ask them what values they find important. But then if you look at what they're actually doing, you have a big gap between actual behavior and what their values are. And the sources of meaning are what people really do in their lives, what really is below their actions, their attitudes. So this is an important distinction. And the scales actually measure what people do of those things they find important. And not just, what do you find important? And we also don't ask them, is this a source of meaning? But we try to get at it from different sides of attitudes, of behaviors, of regular activities. And the important thing is also by using this approach that often in meaning research, people ask their respondents to tell them, what are your major sources of meaning and so on. And then people usually say it's family, it's friends, it's work. But you don't know what that actually means, because work can mean so many different things. For one person, it's the possibility to be creative. For another, it's community with their colleagues. For another, it's the possibility to expand their knowledge. And you can have many different meanings. Mm-hmm. And that's why the SOMI actually goes to the ultimate meanings. It doesn't remain on the surface of contents. And this tells us much more about why people do what than just by asking them, what is meaningful in your life? And they give you something from the top of your head. It is important because those sources of meaning are not conscious. We are not really aware of them, but we can reflect upon them when someone really tries hard, for example, by lettering.
Important here, I recognize, is your use of the term ultimate meaning. Mm-hmm. It seems like, if I understand you correctly, that sources of meaning isn't specifically, it's kind of religiously neutral or non-religiously neutral. It can apply to both people who may consider themselves religious and people who could be atheist or otherwise. Could you explain perhaps some of the applications of that in both the religious and secular, non-religious, or atheist, non-belief population?
Yes, exactly. That's very important because many people nowadays are not religious, but still have something that fulfills them. And when we had the big inventory of possible sources of meaning and we are now able to measure them simultaneously, we can see, for example, how important religiosity is in somebody's life and which other sources of meaning actually are relevant. And that means people who are atheists, who are agnostic, who won't be spiritual or religious, will probably have other self-transcendent commitments, for example, horizontal self-transcendence in generativity or unison with nature. And by applying this inventory, we can get a quite broad picture of where people actually put their heart and where meaning can take place even if religiosity or spirituality are not present. Mm-hmm. And usually we only measure them, and if they are not there, we don't really know what is there.
Yeah.
And that's why many people would think, well, atheists don't have a meaningful life, do they? How could they? They don't have meaning in religiosity and spirituality. You can have meaning in other ways too.
You're saying instead of comparing something that is, like belief, however mm-hmm. that may manifest with something that it's already decidedly not,
yes.
non-belief or non-religion, that's
yes.
not really a comparison in your book, right? But the
yes.
sources of meaning allows for a comparison to take place at the ultimate highest level.
Exactly, and it also allows us to see similarities between people who seem to be very different. For example, when comparing an atheist to a religious person, you might see that in many ways they have a very similar commitment, but one has a vertical transcendence, believing in God, and the other hasn't, but what they actually live is very similar, what they are committed to. And then you can also see the centrality of religiosity. Some people have a moderate degree of religiosity, but other things are more important than that. And another interesting point is that there are some non-religious people who are spiritual, and even some atheists or agnostics who call themselves, or who have relatively high degrees in spirituality, and these are interesting cases that would just be ignored if we ask, are you atheist, are you spiritual, are you religious?
Are there any particular correlates related to the sources of meaning scale in terms of validating and aligning your scale
mm-hmm.
with others? Where does it situate?
An important question, of course, is how it is related to personality.
Mm-hmm.
We linked it to the Big Five, of course, and one important point is that personality factors can hardly predict the amount of meaningfulness a person reports, which I think is a very good thing, because that means everybody can actually have a meaningful life. But which sources of meaning we actually commit to is strongly predicted by personality variables. So not everybody has the same access to, for example, vertical self-transcendence, or to relatedness, or to order or self-actualization. That is quite dependent on as who you are born. But of course it's not completely determined by that. You can always challenge yourself and try things that take you somewhere else.
How many sources of meaning have you identified? If I understand correctly, it was around 26? Is there any way you could briefly cover, don't have to all of them, but some that maybe are particularly meaningful to you, or that
mm-hmm.
you think might be relevant for research in the
uh-huh.
psychology of religion
uh-huh.
area?
Maybe it's best to give a short overview, because factor analysis allows us to have five dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
And the first two are actually sub-dimensions of self-transcendence, and we decided to differentiate vertical from horizontal, because they are two very different things. Vertical self-transcendence, here we have spirituality or religiosity. Horizontal self-transcendence is if you are committed to something broader than yourself, greater than yourself, but in this world, not relating to something supernatural, which could be nature, the society, social commitment, generativity, and so on. Then we have self-actualization, which is a collection of sources of meaning that have to do with growing and expanding my potentials. This is knowledge and power and achievement and creativity.
Mm.
We have the dimension called order, which is a more conservative dimension with reason, morality, practicality in it. And the last is well-being and relatedness, which turned out to be things that either have to do with being friendly with myself, in a sense of attentiveness and harmony and fun and love, and also with others, like care and communion. And these things belong together very much. They all always load on one factor. And when we ask, or when we conduct analysis to find out what are the most important sources of meaning when it comes to meaningfulness, which are the best predictors, then the one that always stands out is generativity, doing something that the generations after us will still profit from, or something that actually adds value to the society, to a greater whole. And in younger and in older people in psychiatry and in different countries, we always have this scale standing out as the best predictor of meaningfulness.
The generativity?
Generativity, mm-hmm. And altogether, self-transcendence seems to be very important for meaning.
The self-transcendence,
mm-hmm.
is dimension. We both certainly have an interest in the horizontal and vertical dimensions of transcendence. I wonder if you'd go in a little bit further on horizontal uh-huh. transcendence. What is it, and what might it be? What might we find out that
yes.
it is?
Uh-huh. Self-transcendence is conceptualized as a way of living that is not centered on my personal well-being, but the readiness to ignore personal wishes, or to also do something that is not very comfortable for myself, or maybe even harmful for a greater good. And this greater whole can be conceptualized as a higher power, as God. But other people see in it humanity or society or nature, something that is worth committing to more than my own personal well-being. So I transcend myself in the sense of I'm doing something that not only I am benefiting from, but I do it for something else, for a greater whole.
Essentially, you know, there's always a debate of whether there's a religious dimension. Is everyone religious? Where would horizontal and vertical transcendence fit in with that? Could everyone, you know, is everyone situated somewhere along this continuum, perhaps of horizontal and vertical mm-hmm. transcendence? Is it possible to not have one or the other?
Yeah, well, if you do dimensional measuring, then people reply to these items and they agree with the items or they don't. So everybody has a value from 0 to 5. That means you can either not be at all horizontally or vertically transcendent, or moderately or highly. So everybody can refer to it and locate themselves.
Is all of that religion? Would horizontal transcendence, would that person be religious or implicitly religious?
Oh, that's a good question. Who is implicitly religious? We're not really sure how to define
that. That doesn't exist. Is there such a thing as being implicitly religious?
Well, there's a whole research tradition. Now I'm dealing with that question for decades, and that's actually how I started my research in implicit religion. And I said people can be implicitly religious when they don't, even if they don't see themselves as religious, but they still have personal myths, they have personal rituals, and they do experience transcendence. But it's very hard to operationalize that. I tried it, but it's very complex, so I've left that aside. And yeah.
Is there a difference between the transcendent with a capital T and perhaps transcendence with a smaller T?
Yes.
I wonder if you could touch on that for a moment.
Yes, very important. Transcendence with a big T, with a capital T, is the supernatural in a way. That's how we associate with it, isn't it? But everybody can transcend in the sense of the verb to transcend. And you can transcend different levels. You can transcend yourself to your inner self, to your true self, which is a kind of self-knowledge. You try to find out who you really are, not what you show to everybody, and it's a search of your real self. You transcend to your real self. You can transcend to another person, as in love. You can transcend into a community, as you have in football stadium. You can transcend into nature. You can transcend and have a religious experience, a mystical experience with a higher power. So there are different levels, and transcendence with a capital T does not always have to be involved in transcending.
It certainly sounds like you're calling for an expanded scope in the psychology of religion, and perhaps that's the psychology of religion might not even be a proper name for where this field is going. Mm-hmm. I wondered if maybe you could touch on that.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point, because religion is very much associated with the institution of the church, and as a term, it's difficult to work with it. I would not want to use spirituality instead, what many people vote for, because that's such a very fuzzy term, as we know.
Fuzzy. Unfuzzying the fuzzy.
Meaning would really be a very broad concept that covers it all. And we saw also in research on religion, religion only has a positive effect on well-being, health, and so on, if it is experienced as meaningful. So the meaning seems to be the center of it. And if you are religious in a nominal way, in a if you don't really live it, it's not the source of meaning. But as soon as it becomes the source of meaning, then things can happen. So the meaning seems to be the core, and we can have meaning in religion, in spirituality, and in other things. And if we want to broaden our scope in the psychology of religion and also include people who are not religious and maybe not even spiritual, then we should probably work with a concept of meaning.
Certainly seems like a wonderful idea and concept to expand the scope, but also stay true to the roots and still understanding a substantive definition with the capital T, and also opening up to other sources, allowing for comparison.
Yeah.
How does meaning relate specifically to religion, religiosity, and spirituality?
There is a strong link between religion, spirituality, and meaning if it is relevant in a person's life. So if it is really pronounced, if there is a high value, then it's a strong meaning maker.
We're talking about if someone acknowledges that something is deemed religious, that they find this to be religious and meaningful to them, correct?
If people are religious in a deep way, then they experience their life as meaningful. That's usually the case. Very strong correlation. There are very few people in Western Europe that actually do describe themselves as very religious, but if they do, then it's connected with high meaningfulness. And spirituality is a bit different, because there seem to be subtypes of spirituality. Spirituality is also linked to meaning, but we also found that some types of spirituality, especially those who are not religious, are quite depressed, anxious, angry, neurotic, and here we have to differentiate also in the correlation with meaningfulness.
What are some other particular applications of your theory of meaning and the sources of meaning scale?
There are, you can actually apply to all kinds of fields.
Maybe just two or three.
Yeah. For example, in psychotherapy, in a phase after a traumatic situation, for example, a trauma is a situation where the floor opens up below your feet, and what had been there as substantial and carrying you is often questioned. And that is the phase where people look for meaning either anew or try to get back to what they had as meaningful. And the SOMI can be used to see what resources are there, what can these people actually relate to, what kinds of sources of meaning, what can we work on, and what are sources of meaning that are so little developed that there seems to be a kind of anxiety to touch them, or also an imbalance. If you look at profiles of the SOMI, and there are people who are, for example, who are only self-actualizers, who are neither into well-being and related nor in self-transcendence, they are usually not well-off at all. So a balance or a diversity of sources of meaning in your life seems to be very important, and that's something you can identify very well. Another thing is in the work context. Here the meaning concept is becoming quite important, because people nowadays are not so interested anymore, and it seems in making a career and getting more and more money, but they ask, why am I doing what I'm doing? So managers and employers are wondering, so what shall we do now?
There's a purpose question involved.
Exactly. Yes, and the thing is, meaning cannot be implemented. You can't have a meaning-making strategy, because meaningfulness also has to do with the systems you are part of. If you work in a company, for example, that promotes values that are not coherent with your values, you're in a difficult situation. So you probably will not find that work meaningful if it contradicts your values.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you are in a company that has certain values on promotes certain values on the outside, but in the inside you notice they're not living them. The managers don't walk the talk. That makes people cynical, as several studies have shown, and you don't engage anymore for work. You don't find it meaningful. So it's not only in you to create meaning or to find meaning. It also means the systems and the environment you're in have to fit, and there has to be an authenticity on different levels. So it's something that has to do also with societal change. As an individual, I cannot just create meaning. We probably also have to start acting up and changing conditions and situations on a higher level.
It certainly seems like you're not saying it's meaning or meaning making is relative, but it is relational.
Very good, yes. Exactly, yeah.
Uh-huh. I was wondering if you could touch upon or speak to a cross-cultural perspective of meaning making and how such research could be explored.
We're just starting cross-cultural research together also.
How many different countries?
Well, the Somi is translated into 11 languages now, and we have samples from France, from Bulgaria, from Denmark, from Brazil. Well, I probably forgot some now, but we will soon bring them all together. And one of the questions that we are interested in most right now is why there are so many people who don't live a meaningful life but who don't have any problem with that. They don't suffer from a crisis of meaning, but they don't think their life is in any way meaningful. We call them the existentially indifferent. And in Germany, for example, there are 35% who belong to this group. And that is kind of mystery, I think, because Germany is a quite well-off country. People could do a lot to live out their needs, their ideas, but why are they so indifferent? And there seem to be different kinds of indifference. Either, or first there is one induced by few chances, especially among younger people who don't see a chance of getting a job, who don't feel welcomed by the society as an adult, who just think, well, I can't do anything, I don't have much chances, so I better don't care. That's much better for me than having high hopes that then will be unfulfilled. But then there are also quite many adult working people who live their life in a quite superficial way. They go to work, then they watch TV, then they go to work again, watch TV again, and something is lacking. And we have to find out what's going on there, why is that, where's the intensity and the passion gone?
Is there anything else you'd like to tell us about meaning making or the process of which some of research participants, the people you study, go about making meaning?
Mm-hmm. The term making meaning is a bit misleading because it sounds as if you can just build your own meaning.
Snap your fingers exactly. And made some meaning.
Exactly. Well, but through the research, we now know that certain activities, for example, or certain attitudes are helpful. There's a new line of research that is very helpful in that sense, and it's on hedonic and eudaimonic well-being. Probably you've heard about it. In psychology, for a long time we have measured well-being as satisfaction with life, as many positive effects and emotions as possible, and as little pain and negative effect as possible. But that's quite hedonistic. If you want a is that really a good life, what we measure here, this kind of well-being?
Whatever makes one happy.
Yeah.
You know, obviously that differs for different people.
Yes, but it's, that's true, but it's the maximization of lust, we say of lust, the Freudian term,
yes.
Of positive experience and as little as possible negative experiences doesn't really mean you actually live a life that you think is good in a higher sense. I like this this saying by John Stuart Mill. He wondered in one of his writings, what is better, to be a satisfied cow or an unsatisfied Socrates? And I think as a human being, it's an important question. Shouldn't we acknowledge our possibility of complexity that actually leads us also into dilemmas?
Mm-hmm.
That gives us a chance to live a more intense and a deeper life than just a satisfied life. And the concept of eudaimonic well-being, taken from Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, is the life where I actually live out my abilities that
like a eudaimonia.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. And his concept is about the good life, and the good life is not necessarily the pleasant life, and that's important. And it's easily graspable if you think of situations where you are in a situation where you are, you see someone is being done harm. What should you do? Should you put yourself into danger by helping, or should you better stay away and be safe? If you would act upon your values, you would probably do something where you will be harmed. But it would be the right thing. On a bigger scale, I like to quote Etty Hillison. She was a Jewish student in Amsterdam during fascism. And she wrote a diary in which she reports how she slowly realizes what's going on, that Jews are being killed, that also she will probably be killed. But she also falls in love. She tries to find out who she is, and she explores herself. She develops a kind of God in her own heart that she prays to. And it's a very full internal life. And she does things that she finds important and right. She does things to help her fellow Jews as much as she can. She takes on a lot of hardships to do that. And that's not easy and pleasant at all. And then she says, but still, if I look at my life, I find my life is meaningful. I don't actually say it in the situation I'm in, but my life is meaningful. If I see it all in the bigger picture, there's such a beauty in it. And my life is beautiful, she said, and her life was far from pleasantness, but still it was meaningful. And we need to make that distinction.
Meaning is acted on.
Meaning is acted on, and meaning is not always happiness. So you can't expect, if you have a meaningful life, to be happy and chirpy, but you can expect to have a sense of, yeah, I think when I look back on my life, when I'm dying, I'll say, yeah, I did the right things.
Maybe to bring this to a close here, I was wondering if you couldn't reflect for a minute, or I guess better, share with us where you think the social scientific study of religion is headed in the future with regards to a specific focus on meaning and the process by which people may or may not make meaning.
Mm-hmm. I see a big difference in the cultures between America and Europe, of course. In America, you still have a kind of religiosity that is what we have measured for a long time, but many of these concepts do not really apply anymore in Europe, especially in the northern parts of Europe. But still, people are existential beings, and they have existential needs. And it is important to acknowledge that, to explore it, and to see it, even if it's not religion as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
And by looking for meaning and other open concepts, I think the psychology of religion can react upon these developments and also learn from what real religion, in brackets, can, what it can do, why it is such a big meaning maker, and use this knowledge to transform it into maybe secular or other ways of existential assistance, mm-hmm. care, and so on.
Just for our audience here, if they were interested in using your sources of meaning scale, where would they be able to find it, or how could they contact you or find the scale to use in some of their own work?
Mm-hmm. The German version is licensed by Hochgriffe, so that has to be bought. But they said that the English version can be distributed freely. So if anybody wants to use the English version, just contact me by email and I can send it. And all the other translations you can see on my webpage, which translations are available.
Your webpage.
My webpage is www.sinforschung.org. Sinforschung is sinforschung.org.
Make sure to also put that in print, so with a link to it.
Yes.
Dr. Tatiana Schnell, we want to thank you very much for joining us here on the Religious Studies Project today. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
So, thanks, Tommy, and thanks, Tatiana. Or should I say, so me.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talked quite extensively about this last week.
We did. I don't think we need to belabor that point.
Yeah. What will be fun to talk about, though... last week, and actually, I was almost caught a little bit by surprise this as well. April Fool's Day, you may have noticed. It'll still be on the RSP page if you want to go and see what we did on April Fool's Day if you missed it. But
so yeah, I hope you enjoyed the theological dispatch that we were there for 24 hours.
Yeah, it was quite an interesting. I'm waiting for Russell McCutcheon to write a. Culture on the Edge. Post
yeah.
about it, actually, the ensuing discourse that surrounded both the implications of our post and the discussions that followed on social media and on other blogs. So I'm looking forward to it.
I'm not sure whether I should say anything because I was considering responding to that post, but I haven't as yet, but I may well have by the time this comes out, so...
Yep.
I think I'll have to leave that shrouded in mystery. We may have reached fisticuffs by the time this comes out.
Yeah, but it was quite fun. And sorry to those of you, including some of our assistant editors, who were somewhat shocked,
yeah. caught on the back foot. I think.
But that was an excellent job, and. Just for legal reasons, in case the John Templeton Foundations eventually hunt us down, it was all Knut's idea.
I can confirm that. He is a webmaster. We couldn't have done it without him.
So
that proves it.
He's the one. Next week, well, first off, we hope you enjoyed the roundtable last week from that camp. We've got Dave McConaughey coming back next week, speaking with Sean McLeod about spiritual warfare. Which might tie in quite nicely with Per's interview with Mark Juergensmeyer on this sort of
cosmic
war and
yeah.
There was a brilliant word like sociotheology or something. I don't know.
That's what Juergensmeyer called it, sociotheology. But I think we at the time we sort of agreed that sociotheology seemed to just be what we call religious studies.
Yeah.
So, analyzing the theological systems of other people without. Trying to decide whether they're correct or not. This seemed to be quite a remarkable idea to him, and I don't know why.
Yeah, so Daniel Dennett saying, we need to study religion scientifically, it's not been done before.
The Theosophical Society in 1899, just saying. Or 1889, sorry.
We hope you're enjoying our witty banter here, folks. Just in case you forget to say, we are presented in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, Google+. Keep using those Amazon links. It's going really well at the moment, and it does mean a lot to us means that we're increasingly becoming more sort of self-sufficient, as it were. I think we might as well cut the
bad. Yeah, we've got some other stuff to tell you next week, but we'll do that next week. So for now, I'll just say
thanks for listening.